My name is Dominic Statham. This is me, aged 19, as a student at Loughborough University. Do you think it looks like me? Oh, definitely. Good. I was sponsored through my university course by Rolls-Royce and then went to work for them for a number of years after graduating. I worked on this engine here, the RB199, which powers the Panavia Tornado. Also this one, the Pegasus engine, which powers the Harrier jump jet. I then moved to the automotive industry, and in my last job, I helped design Jaguar and Land Rover vehicles. My very last assignment, I worked on the part of the vehicle known as the driveline. That's how you get the power from the engine to the wheels. In my very last job, I had to solve a particularly difficult vibration problem, which required me to do quite a lot of hairy mathematics, and I'm still getting over it. I now work for the Christian organisation Creation Ministries International. And as a Bible-believing Christian, I take the Bible to be the Word of God and true in everything it teaches. So when the Bible tells me that God created everything in just 6 days, just thousands of years ago, I believe it. I also believe the Bible when it teaches that God created people specially and supernaturally from the dust of the earth, rather than this idea that we evolved from ape-like creatures. And at Creation Ministries International, we seek to uphold the Bible from the very first verse. We are primarily an information ministry, providing people in the church with tools and information with which they can defend the Christian faith. We want to encourage Christians to hold fast to the Bible as the Word of God. And also we want to help equip the church to reach out to a fallen and lost world. And I'm here today to make it clear that when it comes to science, Bible-believing Christians are not in difficulties, and that the Bible is a book that can be trusted. Now, if you'd like to know more about our ministry and would like to receive our free InfoBytes email, then in just a moment we're going to pass around some clipboards so that you can sign up for this if you'd like to. InfoBytes will enable you to read our responses to the latest media stories about science and the Bible and creation and evolution. This is an example of one news item we had recently dealing with the issue of whether the Bible really teaches that the earth is stationary and that the universe revolves around it. We don't believe the Bible does teach that. Here's another about how embracing evolutionary beliefs sometimes turns pastors into atheists. And I can assure you it does happen. This one responds to a claim by National Geographic magazine that creationists are at war with science. InfoBytes will also keep you in touch with our latest news, bookstore offers, and so on. So if you'd like to receive our free InfoBytes email, please do put your details on the form. And if you do so, we'd like to give you an assurance that we won't pass those details on to anybody else. So we've got a couple here that we can pass around, and one here as well. Please make sure they don't get stuck at the end of a row. So, it's a free InfoBytes email. We also have a website, and the web address is very easy to remember, creation.com. There's a search engine there in the top right-hand corner, and this enables people to enter keywords representing any question that they might have about this subject, about creation and evolution and science and the Bible. On creation.com, you'll also find Parents' Corner, which supports those involved in homeschooling and also other parents keen to help their children learn about creation. We're a small organisation, but we do have offices in various parts of the world. In the UK, we have 3 full-time staff and 4 part-time staff, manning the office, taking telephone orders, and so on. Worldwide, we have 12 PhD scientists, all of whom could be earning far more money in secular employment. Some have given up their retirement years to serving God in this ministry. But why? Why do people do it? Why do people regard this work as so important? Well, we had this feedback quite recently from a youth worker in Australia. And she said this. She said, "I used to beat my head against a wall, wondering why we lost all our young people at about age 16. I've realized that age 16 is when they teach evolution in depth in science. Some of the teachers actually identify the Christian students and make a special point of explaining the differences and difficulties in reconciling Genesis and the so-called facts of evolution. It's no wonder we lost them. I come near to tears just thinking about it." I was speaking recently to a British religious education teacher, and she told me that at age 11 or 12, when she teaches the youngsters about God and creation, they accept it. But by the time they've had a few years of so-called science teaching, they no longer believe. And you know, this can be a real issue for the youngsters of Christian families. Unless they're equipped to answer what their teachers are saying about science having contradicted the Bible, some of them are really going to struggle. And it's not hard to imagine the scenario. Jamie goes along to his church youth group, and the youth leaders encouraging them to share their faith and encourage their friends along. Okay, so Jamie plucks up courage and invites his friend Sam. "Hey Sam, would you like to come along to my youth club?" And Sam replies, "Not really. I believe in science. Charles Darwin proved that we weren't created and that we evolved from apes. And what about dinosaurs? How do they fit into the Bible? They died out millions of years ago, and they could never have fitted into Noah's Ark anyway." Well, Jamie goes home and he asks his dad, and dad's not sure of the answers, so he says, "Well, just have faith, son." But like many teens, Jamie wants answers, and he starts looking elsewhere. But you know, he needn't, because by far, most of the so-called scientific reasons that people give for rejecting the Bible, we have the answers for. Sam asked about dinosaurs. Well, this is one of the questions we answer in the Creation Answers book. You know, the media give people the impression that when it comes to science, Bible-believing Christians are in great difficulties. But you know, this is simply not the case. You know, creation scientists have now found answers to many of the supposedly scientific objections to the Bible. And we've put together responses to the most commonly raised objections to the Bible in this book, the Creation Answers book. Two other excellent resources for the answering the skeptics are these, the Evolution's Achilles Heels book and the accompanying DVD. And I'll be giving a little bit more information about these during the course of the talk. Well, the answer to Sam's question about the dinosaurs is that they could have easily fitted on the ark. The eggs of the great sauropods have now been found as fossils, and they're not much bigger than footballs, which means even the very largest dinosaurs could have fitted onto the ark as juveniles. And the dinosaur fossils that we find all over the earth are the remains of creatures that were buried in the great flood that we read about in the book of Genesis. Now, evolutionists, of course, say that all this is nonsense. And they say that science has shown that the rocks are millions of years old, and science, they say, has shown that the dinosaurs died out around 65 million years ago. But has it? Not long ago, a particularly well-preserved Tyrannosaurus rex was discovered in Montana in the United States. And when they cut the thigh bone, this is what they found, this remarkably fresh-looking appearance. Some of the tissues, like this one here, were still soft and stretchy. They found these branching structures that looked remarkably like blood vessels. And when they squeezed them, out came this stuff on the right that looked remarkably like blood cells. And when they tested these, they found traces of the blood protein, hemoglobin. You know, some of the bone proteins in this dinosaur were so well preserved, they could compare them with the proteins of living animals. You know, organic material like this just doesn't last millions of years. Dr. Mary Schweitzer was the lead scientist supervising this work. And speaking of these well-preserved dinosaur remains, Dr. Schweitzer, who's no young earth creationist, said this. She said, when you think about it, the laws of chemistry and biology and everything else that we know say that it should be gone. It should be degraded completely. And this is true. Everything we know from science tells us that bone tissues, blood cells, and proteins simply would not last millions of years. And this is strong evidence from science that the Bible is true and that the rocks and fossils are not millions of years old. You know, from the New Testament, it's clear that Christ accepted the Old Testament on face value. He believed in a literal six-day creation, a literal Adam and a literal Eve and a literal global flood. But you know, if the evolutionary account of Earth history is true, then the biblical account of Earth history is not true, in which case Christ was wrong. Now, may I ask you some questions? If Christ was wrong in what he had to say about our history, why should anyone believe what he had to say about the future? If he was wrong in what he had to say about the judgment that came through the great flood, why should anyone believe what he had to say about the judgment to come? If he was wrong in what he had to say about Adam, why should anyone believe what he had to say about himself? And if he was wrong about all these things, why should anybody take any notice of what he had to say about God, about morality, and about sin and salvation? Now, I'm sure most here are familiar with Darwin's theory of evolution, this idea that people evolved from primitive life forms over millions of years. An idea that could not be more different to what the Bible teaches. You see, according to the Bible, God made the first man specially and supernaturally from the dust of the earth. According to the Bible, God made him fully formed and physically and morally perfect. But according to Charles Darwin, this isn't true at all. You see, according to Darwin, people evolved from ape-like creatures and by a process of natural selection and survival of the fittest. You know, it's a story of suffering and death from the beginning, where the weaker die off to make way for the stronger. Human life, as we see it today, Darwin taught, came into being through the death of the less fit. And again, all this couldn't be more different to what the Bible teaches. Because you see, according to the Bible, the world that God originally created was perfect. It was a place of beauty, peace, and harmony. A world that reflected the perfectly good nature of its creator. In Genesis chapter 1 and verse 31, we read that God saw everything that he had made. And behold, it was very good. You see, according to the Bible, suffering and death came into the world only after people sinned, after we turned away from God and embraced evil. according to the Bible, suffering and death were not part of God's original creation. But you see, if evolution is true, and the Bible is, then again the Bible is not true in these things. Because you see, if evolution is true, then the reality is this. You see, if evolution is true and the fossil record tells the story of millions of years of evolution by natural selection, then suffering and death were in the world long before people even existed. You see, according to the theory of evolution, death is not the result of sin, as the Bible teaches, but the means by which human life came into being, through natural selection and the death of the less fit. So you see, the two views, evolution by natural selection and biblical creation, couldn't be more different. And this is absolutely no side issue. You see, have you ever been told that God cannot be a good God because of all the suffering in the world? This is the view firmly held by Stephen Fry. When asked recently what he would say to God, if indeed there is a God and he were to meet him, this is how he replied. Bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? Why should I respect a God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? Atheism is not just about not believing there is a God, but on the assumption there is one, what kind of God is he? It's perfectly apparent that he's monstrous and deserves no respect whatsoever. And you know, when professing Christians teach that God created through evolution and survival of the fittest, as some do, they leave their followers with no way of responding to this kind of argument. And I would suggest, too, that for many non-Christians, the idea that a good and loving God perfected his creation through a process of survival of the fittest just doesn't wash. Nobel Prize-winning biologist and atheist Jack Mono would agree. In a TV interview towards the end of his life, he said this: "The struggle for life and elimination of the weakest is a horrible process. I am surprised that a Christian would defend the idea that this is the process which God more or less set up in order to have evolution." And of course, the Bible gives us a very straightforward answer to the arguments of people like Stephen Fry. You see, according to the book of Genesis, the world that God originally created didn't have any of these bad things. Things like suffering and death arose only after sin entered into the world. So they're not God's fault, they're actually our fault. But of course, the Bible also gives us the good news, doesn't it? That God did not want us to remain in this state. He sent his Son, Jesus Christ, into the world to die on the cross so that our sins could be forgiven. And after Christ had died to pay the penalty for sin, God raised him from the dead so that all who would follow him might be empowered to live a new life and one that's pleasing to God. Jesus said that one day he would return and that he would restore the world to its original perfect condition. And he has promised for all who will receive his salvation that there would then be no more suffering and no more death. And that really is good news. Well, I'm sure many here have heard of the Egyptian boy king Tutankhamun. He had a short life, and for many years it was thought that he died due to a hemorrhage following a blow to the head, and that he had been murdered. However, following extensive CT scanning in 2005, a number of experts concluded that there had in fact been no blow to the head. It was suggested that the young king died following a break to the left thigh bone, possibly due to bleeding or a fatal infection. Another team of experts, though, came to a very different conclusion. Tutankhamun, they said, was a deformed, sickly youth who probably died from malaria. The CT scans, they said, showed that he had diseased bones, a club foot, and a cleft palate. And samples of DNA were said to have tested positive for malaria. But Professor James Gamble, an orthopaedic surgeon, has no time for the deformities theory. All this, he said, could have resulted from the mummification process. Two experts from the Bernhardt Institute for Tropical Medicine were also sceptical of the malaria theory. A youth of Tutankhamun's age, they argued, would probably have been immune to the disease. Other experts cast doubt on the DNA tests, claiming that in the warm environment of the tomb, the DNA would probably have degraded in just a few centuries. And they thought the results were probably simply due to contamination. Robert Connolly, a senior lecturer in physical anthropology at Liverpool University, is also sceptical of the weakling malaria theory. A more likely explanation, he says, is that Tutankhamun died following a fall from his chariot. According to Connolly, his chest cavity was caved in and he had broken ribs, consistent with him having suffered such an accident. Professor Frank Rooley of the University of Zurich, however, points out that a fatal accident would probably have damaged other parts of the skeleton, such as the backbone and arms. Dr. Benson Harer, a retired medical professor, has a completely different view. He recently argued that Tutankhamun's damaged thorax indicated that he probably died following a bite from a hippopotamus. Now, despite the fact that all these experts had access to the same information, the same data, they came to very different conclusions. And this is because the data don't speak for themselves. They have to be interpreted. Now, the procedures for collecting the information were objective. CT scans, DNA tests, and so on. But the conclusions drawn were clearly subjective. And the same is true for scientific attempts to try and reconstruct the history of the Earth and its plant and animal life. And I want us now to look very briefly at two types of science, what I shall refer to as operational science and historical science. Now, examples of operational science include Newton's laws of motion, Boyle's law describing the behaviour of gases, and Coulomb's law of electricity. Don't worry if you don't know anything about these, because my point is simply this. These can be tested in a laboratory. Okay? They are not the opinions of so-called experts. They are laws derived from the results of experiments. Now, operational science is very powerful. It's led to remarkable achievements in engineering, computer science, and medicine. I wouldn't knock it. Historical science, though, is very different. Historical science deals with questions like, how did the universe begin? How did life start? How was the Grand Canyon formed? How old is the Earth? And this is a very different type of science, because the answers that people give to questions like these cannot be tested in a laboratory. And they are also always based on unprovable assumptions. Operational science is based on observable, repeatable experiments. Historical science is not. Historical science is unobservable and unrepeatable. In historical science, people make up a story about the past. And it's always a story that fits what they believe about the past. Now, the difference between operational science and historical science is made clear by the fact that, very largely, statements about operational science don't change, whereas statements about historical science are changing all the time. Now, Newton's laws of motion are the same today as when he first stated them, as are Boyle's law describing the behaviour of gases and Coulomb's law of electricity. They have not changed because they were right or required only qualification when they were first formulated. Historical science is very different. The answers that scientists give to questions like this are constantly changing. Every month, and I mean it, every month, we read in some science magazine about some new discovery which is going to require the textbooks on evolution to be rewritten. What sort of science is that? Geologist Professor Derek Ager wrote this. He said, "It must be significant that nearly all the evolutionary stories I learned as a student have now been debunked." What sort of science is that? William Provine is Professor of Evolutionary Biology at Cornell University, and he wrote this. He said, "Most of what I learned in the field of evolutionary biology in graduate school is either wrong or significantly changed." Science that is constantly changing is not science at all. It's no more than storytelling. Real science has been verified by experiments. And very largely, if the experiments are done properly, it doesn't change. Now, scientists have great difficulty determining the cause of death of an Egyptian pharaoh who lived just thousands of years ago, even though considerable attempts were made to preserve the body. How then can they make authoritative statements about events they believe occurred millions of years ago? Well, the answer is they can't. What we can do, though, in respect of science, is ask the question, which view of origins, creation or evolution, fits the facts the best? And in our Evolution's Achilles Heel DVD, we show how the facts fit the theory of evolution very poorly. And if you think that's far-fetched, I challenge you to watch the DVD. Now, in the thinking of evolutionists, there were two steps in the alleged evolutionary process. Okay? In step one, ordinary chemicals supposedly turned into the first living cells, the first living organisms. And then in step two, these first living organisms supposedly turned into people. Okay, so in step one, this is the atheist's origin of life story. Ordinary chemicals somehow turned into the first living organisms, microbes that they say lived in the oceans many millions of years ago. Then in step two, they say that the first living organisms evolved into all the plants and animals we find on the earth today including people. Now, many evolutionists will tell you that this second step, which is known as Darwinian evolution, is very well supported by science. Now, I don't agree with that. I think that's nonsense, but that's what they'll say. But in respect of the first step, how ordinary chemicals supposedly turned into the first living organisms, many evolutionists will freely admit that they have no idea how this could have happened. Professor Stuart Kaufman is one of the leaders in the field of origin of life studies, and he said this: "Anyone who tells you that he or she knows how life started on Earth is a fool or a knave. Nobody knows." Evolutionists know that we do not observe natural processes that can produce life from non-life. They believe by faith that such processes exist. You see, the creation-evolution debate is not about science versus faith. It's about one faith versus another, or one worldview versus another. You know, for evolutionists, the origin of life has proven to be an absolutely intractable problem. And this is because there are so many reasons why observed natural processes would act to prevent this happening rather than to cause it to happen. And in chapter 3 of the Evolution's Achilles Heel book, Dr. Jonathan Safferty, who's particularly well qualified in this area, explains why the idea that natural processes could produce life has absolutely no foundation in science whatsoever. Let me give you an example. Did you know that the molecules needed for life, things like proteins and DNA, actually break down in water? And far more quickly than they'd ever be built up. And at the same time, water is essential for life. So it's a catch-22 situation. If you don't have water, you can't have life. But if you have water, then it will act so as to break down the molecules needed for life. Another subject we deal with in the Evolution's Achilles Heels project is the fossil record. Did you know that there are many fossils in rocks evolutionists say are millions of years old that look just like creatures we know today? One example is the ginkgo plant. The fossil on the left is supposedly 170 million years old. But it looks just the same as the living plant. Here's another example, the coelacanth. Coelacanths, we were told, died out along with the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago. Subsequently, it was discovered that they're still swimming happily in our oceans. According to evolutionary theory, these fish haven't changed significantly in over 360 million years. Now, according to evolutionists, the evolutionary process is so powerful it can change ape-like creatures into people in just 5 or 6 million years. But it didn't seem to change these coelacanths very much in over 360 million years. Do you know, according to evolutionists, that's the time period it took for fish to evolve into people. You know, they've even found fossilized jellyfish in rocks supposedly 500 million years old that look just like jellyfish we find in the oceans today. Very hard for evolutionists to explain that. Another subject we deal with in the Evolution's Achilles Heels project is radioactive dating. Now, how many people here have been told that carbon dating, radiocarbon dating, has proven the Earth to be millions of years old? How many people have heard that? Yeah, okay. This is actually very bad science. When informed scientists argue that the rocks are millions of years old, they're not referring to radiocarbon dating, but other radioactive dating methods. Radiocarbon is used to try and date things which are thought to be just thousands of years old, for example, at an archaeological site. And there's a very good reason for this, and that is that radiocarbon doesn't last very long. And nowhere near millions of years, it wouldn't last. If you had a lump of radiocarbon as massive as the Earth, it would have all decayed away in around a million years. So it's impossible to use radiocarbon to date something to millions of years. Now, this is an article from our Creation magazine, and this explains why radiocarbon actually provides strong evidence that the Earth is not millions of years old. It's been discovered that diamonds, taken from rocks supposedly hundreds of millions of years old, contain significant amounts of radiocarbon. If they were really all these millions of years old, they wouldn't have all this radiocarbon in them. Lots of science like that, pointing to the truth of what the Bible teaches about a recent creation. The Evolution's Achilles' Heels project also deals with geology. Now, many people have been told that the numerous thin layers of which rocks are composed show that they were formed very gradually, that they were built up very slowly, one fine layer after another, over thousands or millions of years. But when some sand was pumped in a water slurry onto a beach in Australia, it was seen to settle in fine layers. This happened in just a few hours. You see, you don't need long periods of time to build up many thin layers. This photograph shows some fossilized trees. You can see them there, fossilized in the upright condition. How could these possibly have remained in place over thousands of years as sediments slowly built up around them? It seems far more likely that they were buried suddenly in a great flood, such as we read of in the book of Genesis. You know, it's often claimed that things that we find in the rocks require very long periods of time to form. It's said, for example, that opal is produced very slowly, over hundreds of thousands of years, and hence the Earth must be much older than that which the Bible teaches. But recently, the Geological Survey of New South Wales made a remarkable admission. The time taken for the formation of opal is probably of the order of weeks to months, not hundreds of thousands of years required by the conventional weathering model. I mean, how many people have been told that, you know, opal proves that the Earth must be very old and that the Bible's wrong? And then they come out with a statement like this when they actually do some proper science and find out the real facts. In chapter 7 of the Evolution's Achilles' Heels book, Dr. John Hartnett deals with the claim that Big Bang theory can explain the origin of the universe. The Big Bang, of course, is the atheist's creation story. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that according to Big Bang theory, the universe came from nothing. They really believe that, that the universe came from nothing. Well, in my view, if you're willing to believe that, you would believe anything. And they say that we're fools to believe in the Bible. You know, Big Bang theory has many serious scientific problems. Contrary to the impressions given by the media, when these secular cosmologists produce their models and do their calculations, they don't work out. And this is made clear by the fact that they have to introduce fudge factors to make the models work. For example, enormous amounts of dark matter. That's matter that can't be observed. You see, it's dark because you can't see it. But they need it in order to make the model work. And more than that, sometimes they end up arguing that the laws of physics must have been different in the past. Again, to make the theory work. It's just so plainly not science. It's faith. And I would argue it's a blind faith, because it's not maintained because of the facts of science, it's maintained despite the facts of science. Chapter 8 of the Evolution's Achilles' Heels book deals with the implications of evolution for ethics and morality. You know, if there's nothing more than matter and energy, and if we're nothing more than bags of chemicals and evolved microbes, let's face it, life has no meaning. According to Professor Richard Dawkins, the theory of evolution makes clear that the universe we observe has no design, no purpose, no evil and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA, he says, neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Similarly, Professor Susan Blackmore tells us, in the end, nothing matters. If you really think about evolution and why we human beings are here, you have to come to the conclusion that we are here for absolutely no reason at all. Professor William Provine goes further. He argues that evolutionary science makes clear that there is, in fact, no basis for morality. This is what he said. Let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear. And these are basically Darwin's views. There are no gods, no purposes, and no goal-directed forces of any kind. There's no life after death. When I die, I am absolutely certain that I am going to be dead. That's the end of me. There is no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning in life, and no free will for humans either. And you know, this is being taught to our youngsters at university as science. I would struggle to think of a more dangerous doctrine with which to raise the next generation. That science has shown that there's no basis for morality and ethics. And you know, this kind of secular onslaught is not just going on in the universities, it's going on in the schools. And our youngsters need to hear a well-argued alternative view. They need to be helped to see that belief in biblical creation is not just defensible, but it's actually far more rational than what the evolutionists believe. Atheism, incidentally, is a faith. Don't let anyone mislead you. It's every bit as much of a faith as Christianity. Only Christianity makes sense. Last year, I met a Christian head teacher of a state school in Spain, a secular school. And he explained to me why he became involved in the creation ministry. And it was this. He told me that he started to realize how hard it could be for the students coming from Christian families when their science teachers would argue so confidently that science had disproved the Bible. He told me how he came to realize the real inner turmoil of these kids as they struggled when they didn't have answers. It's a real problem for the teenagers today. And this is one of the reasons we produce Creation Magazine. It's to give people the answers. There is no need for Christians to struggle in this area. Science has not disproved the Bible, and it is not difficult to show this. And this is what we do in article after article in Creation Magazine. Creation Magazine's been around for about 35 years. It's distributed now in about 100 countries. It comes out quarterly. It's in full colour. There's none of that annoying paid advertising. And there are articles, for example, responding to the latest pronouncements by people like Richard Dawkins. I can assure you that at Creation Ministries International, we are not the slightest bit intimidated by this man. We just wait for him to make his latest gaffe, and we write about it. And I can assure you he makes plenty of them. This is an article I wrote fairly recently showing how the Bible explains the diversity of life far better than Darwin's theory. There are often articles about astronomy and how the evidence from astronomy actually points to a recent creation, as the Bible teaches. Did you know that? Did you know there are many facts from astronomy which point to the truth of a recent creation? Let me give you an example. Did you know that the moon is constantly moving away from the Earth? This time next year, it will be about 4 centimetres further away from the Earth than it is now. If the moon had really been orbiting the Earth for all the billions of years they say, it would now be far further away from the Earth than it is. And there are many other facts from astronomy supporting a belief in a recent creation. This is an article which explains how Christian beliefs laid the foundations for modern science in the 17th and 18th century. Did you know that secular historians of science will admit that the modern scientific revolution arose out of the Christian worldview? Many of the founders of modern science were biblical creationists. People like Newton, Galileo, Kepler, Boyle, Faraday, Pasteur, and others, they were Bible-believing creationists. And they would write about how their belief in biblical creation inspired them to do their work. You see, the Bible reveals that God is orderly, and God is consistent. You see, we're taught that the theological term is that God is immutable. He doesn't change. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And people like Newton reasoned that if God created, if the God of the Bible created the world that we see around us, then that world probably behaved consistently from day to day. Also, God is revealed in the Bible as a lawgiver. So people like Newton expected to find law in nature. They expected the creation to be orderly, consistent, and governed by law, because that was the nature of its creator. And they looked for law in nature, and they found it. And this is what gave rise to the modern scientific revolution. Now, secularists argue that if we teach creation in schools, it will hamper the youngsters' ability to learn science. But it must be nonsense, because science quite clearly grew out of a belief in creation. Creation Magazine's a family magazine, and there's always a central section for the youngsters. I believe it's true to say that we've had more life-changing testimonies from Creation Magazine than from any of our other materials. Rod Walsh is one of our speakers in Australia, and he told us this after one of his meetings. He said, three people came up to me after the message and told me that Creation Magazine was responsible for their conversion to Christ. This is another feedback we had from Peter L., age 12. He said, your magazine is great. As soon as it comes through the door, the wrapper comes off, and I'm reading it. I wish it came more often. Now, you can't get a better testimony than that, can you? Now, if you're thinking of subscribing, just to encourage you, we do have a special offer on. If you subscribe today for 1 year, we'll give you a free back issue. If you subscribe for 3 years, we'll give you a free back issue and also a free DVD. This is another particularly good offer. You can now get Creation Magazine digitally. So you can read it on your smartphone, your iPad, your laptop, and so on. For just an extra £3 a year on top of the subscription, it can be read on up to 5 different devices. So if you're a grandparent, for example, and you've got 5 grandchildren, and you'd like them all to read Creation Magazine, then for just an extra £3 a year, that could be set up. All 5 members of the family can be reading Creation Magazine. We're going to pass around some clipboards now for those who would like to sign up. If you do sign up, please do pay today at the book table, otherwise you don't get your freebies. You can sign up online, but if you sign up online, you don't get the freebies. I've already mentioned the Creation Answers book. If you're thinking of taking away just one resource from the book table today, I would recommend this one. It answers the most commonly raised questions, objections to science and the Bible. And I think more than any other book, this one demonstrates that Bible-believing Christians really have nothing to be afraid of from science. And I can assure you, it's absolutely true. The people, you wouldn't believe this from the media, but the people who are running scared when it comes to science are the evolutionists. And one of the pieces of evidence, strong evidence for this is provided by the fact that they now refuse to debate creation scientists. Dawkins is on record. He won't debate us, and nor will others. We also have the Evolution's Achilles Heels book and DVD on the book tables. I'd recommend the book for people who have some scientific training. Otherwise, I'd recommend that you watch the DVD. Please do remember to visit our website, creation.com. Remember the search engine there in the top right-hand corner. If you're witnessing to somebody tomorrow, somebody at work, somebody, the neighbours, family, and they raise a supposedly scientific objection to the Bible or to Christianity, and you don't know the answer, come home, get onto creation.com, put some keywords representing the question into the search engine, and you're very likely to find an answer to that question. We've got 9,000 or 10,000 articles now on creation.com answering all sorts of questions about science and the Bible and creation and evolution. You can also download our app, creation.mobi. It's completely free. If you don't know how to do that, don't ask me, because I don't know either. Have a word with someone aged about 10. We've got a few minutes for questions? Yeah. How long have we got for questions? 5 or 10 minutes. Any questions? Yeah, so the question is, given all the discoveries about DNA, you know, how are evolutionists dealing with this? Well, the answer is, the more we discover about DNA, the clearer it becomes that Darwin's theory is completely untenable. And you know, recently they've been doing this work, the ENCODE project. They mapped the human genome, and then they had this ENCODE project where they tried to start working out what all the different bits of DNA did. And they got such a shock. The world's top geneticists began to say that DNA is so complex in the way it works. It's such a complex information system. It's so sophisticated that it might well be the end of the century before we really get a handle on how it works. Now, I ask you this. How can the likes of Richard Dawkins know that natural processes can produce the genome when they don't know how it works? Now, realistically, you don't need to know any science to realize it's ridiculous. How can he possibly know that natural processes can produce something when he doesn't understand how it works? I love talking about DNA because it is the most brilliant, mind-blowing information system that anyone could possibly imagine. I'd love to stop and talk about it for 10 minutes, but I can't. There we are. And any more questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah. So they've started transferring into, is it DNA that they're putting digital information into?
I've not heard of that, but I know they're beginning to discuss that sort of thing. Yeah. Because, of course, it's so small,
yeah.
And yet it contains such an enormous amount of information.
Yeah. Yeah.
It contains, for example, all the information needed to grow a fertilized egg into a baby. And then it contains all the software needed to control what goes on in the cells of our bodies. Absolutely enormous amount of information in such a tiny space. But it's more than that. The genome has an incredible level of data compression. What facilitates the data compression is the genius of the language that it uses. And just to give you a little bit of a flavour for it, if you think of the genome and all the DNA as like an instruction manual for building a baby from a fertilised egg, it does much more than that, but that's one of the things it is. Imagine an instruction manual in English. You go to the first sentence, don't you, and you read it from right to left. Yeah, that's how we read English, don't we? Right to left. Sorry, left to right. Left to right. Okay, and when you've read the first sentence from left to right, you've understood it, you then move on to the same next sentence, don't you, to get the next instruction. Oh, not with DNA. DNA, you might read the first sentence from left to right to get your first instruction. And then get your second instruction by reading the same sentence from right to left. And then, to get your third instruction, you might start a third of the way along the first sentence and read in a third of the way into the next sentence. Some stretches of DNA... this is going back 5 years, so this is probably out of date now. 5 years ago, I was reading that some stretches of DNA are read in up to 7 different ways. I think that's old hat. You see, there are now that people we think there are something like 22,000 genes coding for. They think now there's probably approaching 1 million different proteins in the human body. So you've got about 22,000 genes specifying the form of. Approaching 1 million different proteins. That's a fantastic amount of data compression. Do you know, DNA, I could go on all night. DNA, it operates in 4 dimensions. Because, you see, DNA is wrapped around proteins called histones. And by changing the tightness of the wrap, they actually switch on and switch off genes according to when they're needed. And of course, the DNA is four-dimensional because it reprograms itself over time. You see, you need a different program running in the body when you're a baby to when you're a teenager to when you're an adult. So it reprograms itself so that different programs run at different times. And it just it goes on and on. Animals, when you move them into a different environment, they sense the different environment. And the genome reprograms itself and it changes their form so they adapt to the environment. I could go on. Another question. Oh, they just say that's the hard facts of life. They say it's the truth. How they can work that out, I don't know. But anyway, they say it's the truth. It's a fact. We've just got to live with it.
So they've got no hope?
None at all. No, no. Yeah. But what science has shown it to be true anyway? What science has shown that there's no human spirit and there's no human soul? No science has shown anything of the sort. Have we got time for another question? One more question? Well, the more we learn about science, the more science reveals the greatness of the Creator. Yeah, absolutely.
Can I give you one question?
Sure.
You mentioned a moment ago about dating methods. Say, carbon-14 dating, that's a real popular one that they throw out. How far back can carbon-14 actually test?
Yeah. Probably, in theory, absolute limit would be something like 100,000 years, but more realistically, somewhere like 50,000 years. But of course, that's a theoretical limit.
Yeah.
Just the fact that theoretically radiocarbon could be used to date things doesn't mean that the world's that old.
Because it has like a half-life of 5,000 years, doesn't
it? Yeah, about 5,740 years, I think, yeah. Yeah, quite sure. Yeah. But the great thing is, knowing that it can't last more than about 100,000 years, if you find it in something, that shows that it can't be very old, can't be all these millions of years old. They've now found carbon-14 in dinosaur remains, which is yet another piece of evidence that they're not millions of years old. Thank you.